It's a privilege for me to be able to introduce my colleague Elaine Sorensen Marshall, who is currently serving as the Associate Dean of Research and Scholarly Work in the College of Nursing. She received her nursing degrees and PhD from the University of Utah. Since joining the faculty at Brigham Young University 10 years ago, Dr. Marshall has made nearly 100 invited and peer-reviewed professional presentations in the United States, England, Canada, and Korea. She is currently serving as a family health expert on the TV series Utah Living on KTVX Channel 4. Her research on family health has focused on the qualitative perspective of children using children's artwork and journals. Dr. Marshall received a prestigious national award from the National Council on Family Relations for her book, Children's Stress and Coping, A Family Perspective. She is a member of the Western Academy of Nursing, a recipient of the BYU Alumni Professorship Award and other writing awards. Sister Marshall spent her early childhood on a farm in Liberty, Utah, and served a health services mission to Columbia. She has served in the Young Women and Relief Society presidencies and on the General Relief Society and Church Curriculum Writing Committees. Elaine is the mother of Brian, Chad, Joanna, and Todd Sorensen. She and her physician husband, Dr. John Marshall, are the grandparents to 15 grandchildren. She is a bright and articulate colleague and mentor whose positive energy has blessed my life, a dear friend, a woman of faith, and a caring professional.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm humbled and grateful for this honor. I also want to thank my husband and children for their love and support. When I'm nervous, I usually get relief by telling a funny story about someone in my family, though they begged me not to do that. But I'd like you to know them. My husband is a gynecologist, so I probably can't tell anything funny about him. My son Brian is majoring in molecular biology and hopes to do research, and I wrote this down, on the development of retroviral vectors and transduction of multiple anti-HIV genes, such as ribozymes and decoys. I can't even tell if that's funny. My lovely Joanna is 15. There's nothing funny about being 15, but it's better than being 13. And my son Chad, who hasn't spoken a complete sentence to me in 10 years, is now fluently and happily teaching the gospel in Spanish in Madrid. I remember the first day after graduation when I set out to practice nursing. It was spring, and the air crackled across my new stiff white uniform. I had dressed so carefully in the early morning before the sun found the sky. Those were the days when the knowledge and efficiency of the nurse, and we were overwhelmingly women, were marked by her uniform, which was part military dress whites and part religious habit. White stockings held by a girdle, shoes so ugly and therapeutic that they required a prescription to wear, and the cap, like the graduation robe that represented my alma mater, was the crown that tucked my long hair with color then bright with youth. I couldn't wait to practice the science I had learned, a positivist science born of medicine, arrogant in its confidence in cause and effect, objectivity, and reductionist measurement. Applied in a practice of manipulation of instruments, titration of fluids, and precision of skills. With exhilaration of new knowledge, I also anxiously began my practice of the art of nursing, a knowledge laden with tradition. I learned that the opening of the patient's pillowcase was always placed away from the door. Don't ask me why. AM and PM care included hand and face washing, back rub, and a tactful question about the last bowel movement. And a good bath allowed the patient to submerge a foot in the basin without spilling water on the bed. I loved the order, the science, the art, and the tradition of caring. I later worked in a newborn intensive care unit where I checked monitors more than mothers. I worked a summer in the hollers of Appalachia and served a mission to Colombia in South America and raised four children alone. New worlds opened of needs, meanings, and expanded views of people and their struggles. As life experience has tempered my fascination with tubes and procedures, I'm increasingly drawn to the human drama, the experience and meanings of health and illness, life and death. Learning in science, humanities, and the arts is a search for truth, a search for knowing. It is important not only what we know, but how we know and from what which sources we seek to know. My colleague in psychology, Brent Slive, says that the ideas behind our ideas matter. Today, I would like us to think about how we know and how our knowing changes us. My children have worried that a talk on perspectives of knowing might be too boring. They've teased that the word epistemology sounds like something disgusting. But I hope that this may be, as I heard Mark Twain say about the music of Richard Wagner, it's not as bad as it sounds. As scientists and artists whose work ultimately serves people, I would like us to think about how we might be engaged in a human science. I don't have a specific definition for human science. My son groaned when he thought I made it up. I did not. You may have to decide what it is. Nursing explains and cares about human phenomena in health and illness. In other words, like other practice disciplines, we exist to help people. Today, as I speak of ways of knowing about families and health, particularly from the child's perspective, I ask you to consider how these ideas may apply to your own discipline. There are a number of ways of knowing in human studies. We learn by trial and error, sometimes called the educated guess, then guess again. Much of what we learn as students is by authority. We have never seen, heard, or touched Julius Caesar, but we know he existed and was the emperor of Rome, by our trust in the authority of a teacher or a textbook. Knowing also comes from tradition. Lawyers learn the Socratic method and practice by precedent, both of which emerge from knowledge by tradition. Hospital routines are laden by practice by tradition. There's a growing interest in multiple intelligences and even gender-based ways of knowing. Intelligence generally refers to capacities for computing information, solving problems, or cognitive sets of know-how. I would like us to think of knowing as broader and inclusive of perspectives and values, and of intelligence in the way we know it as light and truth. One gift of studying truth at this university is the privilege to consider spiritual ways of knowing. For some time, nursing theorists have discussed at least four patterns of knowing. They are empirics, ethics, personal knowledge, and aesthetics. Empirical knowing is obviously most accepted, and I'll talk about it later. Ethical knowing is not unique to nursing and is sometimes most difficult to approach in any science. Choosing the right or good requires a knowledge of morality that goes beyond simply knowing the rules, norms, or codes. Human scientists and practitioners are faced with decisions about who is born, to what measure of quality one lives, how and even when one dies. Empirical observations and measurements are helpful, but ultimately a different kind of knowing is required in the ethical domain. Personal knowledge includes insights, intuition, or skill in the therapeutic use of self born of experience. There is a knowing that is gained from the I-thou encounter that transcends empirical measurement. Dean Sandra Rogers shared the following example that I believe shows both ethical and personal knowledge from a BYU nursing student's clinical journal. She wrote, "I learned the deeper meaning of charity when I cared for a wheelchair-bound HIV patient. He had lesions on his hands and buttocks, was pale as a ghost with a splotchy red rash consuming his body, and wore dark glasses which made him seem even ghastlier. His partner sat at his bedside. Initially looking at the man made me physically ill. I wanted to hold my breath, toss the patient his gown, and spend as little time in the room as possible, for I feared that inevitably he would sneeze. Somehow I would catch his disease and then bring it home to my husband and 10-month-old baby. However, one day his mother entered the room. When she went to him, kissed him on the forehead and whispered, 'Sweetheart, I will never leave you.' The words 'charity never faileth' came to mind and my soul melted. I put on my gloves, picked up a bottle of lotion at his bedside and asked him if he wanted a back rub. That day, I felt I understood the words of the Savior as never before. 'If ye have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me.' That student came to know something important that would contribute to her professional practice that she would not have known by tradition, authority, or the scientific method. Aesthetic knowledge has been said to represent the art of practice. There are elements of any human enterprise that cry for art, and I'm talking about more than the pink and forest green wallpaper and oak furniture in the current hospital birthing rooms. Human beings need whatever is that substance that is abstract, beyond discursive language, that uplifts, informs, and enlightens. We come to know something from art and music as humanists and artists, but we've documented so little of their power in the sciences. We know a little about the effect of color on the walls of treatment rooms, the effect of music on anxiety and symptom management, largely from a positivist perspective, but we know very little about helping people from an aesthetic perspective. We need to know more about the power of imagery, meaning and empathy, transcending presence, or human timing and rhythm. These and other ways of knowing seem important enough that they might be validated in a human science. We could develop systematic methods that allow for the expansion of our knowledge with rigor and reliability, so that such insights are legitimized and not relegated to marginal categories of alternative, serendipity, or anecdotal. Empirical knowing is our most revered approach to science. It is the tradition of science. To most of us, it is science. We think the only way we know anything for sure is by the scientific method. Empirics, or positivism, is knowing by objective measurement and observation of information drawn from the senses, with a deductive focus on problems. It works for things that are concrete, rule-driven, and follow linear lines of causality. We need empirical language and empirical knowledge. Otherwise, my husband's surgery would be sorcery, and my son would have no major. The scientific method is successful because it does not attempt to answer all possible questions about all things. My friend Brent Slife has challenged two common assumptions about empirical knowing. The first is pragmatism, the notion that we simply do what works. Pragmatism allows us to focus on efficiency. It gives us reason to simply pursue skills, professional vocations, and wealth. After all, as long as we use our knowledge and wealth to benefit others by our pragmatism, what else do we need to know? In a time of acute cost and profit awareness in healthcare, the wholesale embrace of pragmatism poses a significant risk to our sensitivity to human knowing. Dr. Slive's second challenge is what he calls scientism, the position that the neutral, objective, and sometimes mechanical method of science will eventually answer all our questions. Some positivists even believe that all phenomena may eventually be explained by a small number of natural laws derived from objective empirical study. This approach insists on the supremacy of data measured by the senses over ideas and human interpretations. Truman Matson pointed out that positivism, with its insistence on the senses, is a splendid method for science, though he says even scientists with their precise instruments cannot see electrons. He continues, neither can one see one's past, one's guilt, nor the pain or peace of conscience. It does not follow that he or she cannot know them. One common claim to objectivity of a pragmatic or scientific approach is that there are no assumptions or biases. However, Abraham Kaplan noted that no human perception is immaculate. We always know something already, and this knowledge is intimately involved with what we come to know next. We see what we expect to see. And Heisenberg wrote, "What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning." Nurse theorist Afaf Malise asserted, in our zeal for empirical precision, for adjusting our interest to correspond with a limited definition of science, we may have investigated minutiae, replicated more minutiae, and published inconsequential findings. A human science is not simply a collection of true statements that are valid, reliable through replication, objective in nature, and devoid of prejudices or biases. Rather, it is a human process that engages both the scientist and the subject of its study in a dialogue to help in understanding the nature of the phenomenon and in revealing its meaning to all concerned and to humanity in general. The challenge is what difference our research makes to humanity. Brent Slife pointed out that perhaps we don't have the scientific method, but a scientific method that I propose might be expanded. When we recognize our assumptions and become aware of our own perspective, we can then be open to alternative assumptions and become sensitive to the perspective of those we study. It can be a challenging, risky enterprise to push the margins of our own perspective. We have to let go of the safety of our own view of reality and submit to a vulnerability that we have long required of our research subjects. We have to accept that some phenomena may at first appear to be nonsense. For example, though a positivist one, only a few years ago we treated ulcers as side effects of troubled perfectionist personalities. We poured antacids and cream into stomach tubes every half hour. Then it would have been nonsense to consider antibiotics, which is now the effective treatment. The physicist Zhukov said, "What is nonsense and what is not, then, may merely be a matter of perspective." The more narrow and rigid our own perspective, the more difficult to see that of another. In 1927, Harry Warner, who had successfully produced moving pictures, responded to the new nonsense idea of sound and talking pictures when he said, "Who the hell wants to hear actors talk?" Later that same year, the young Daryl Zanuck produced The Jazz Singer, and Al Jolson became the first actor to talk in a movie. We teach children perspective taken when we say, "Susie, don't hit your brother, imagine how he feels." One social scientist, Sarah Ruddick, has described what she calls maternal thinking, referring to the ability of a parent to take the perspective of the child, to get inside the child's thinking and emotions. It requires a unique type of intellectual reflection, empathy, judgment, and emotion by which parents, particularly mothers, connect with their own young children. We asked parents and school-aged children to keep diaries on stress and coping for 6 weeks. Parents were to report daily stress experiences as they perceived their child might answer. In other words, to take the perspective of their own child. Then we compared parent and child diary entries. Children whose parents were able to assume their perspective, shown by agreement in detail with their reported stress experiences, had a higher number of days where they reported no stress at all. In other words, in families where parents were able to effectively take the perspective of the child, children reported less stress. We saw other positive patterns among attentive parents and sharing children. Parents who were less able to take the perspective of their own child were more likely to report their own stress as the child's experience. They showed a pattern of using the journals as a vehicle to explain or justify their own behavior that might have influenced the child's diary. Or they simply appeared to be too busy in their own lives to notice the nuances of the child's experience. Besides awareness of perspective, to achieve validity in a human science, we must accept people as expert witnesses of their own life experiences. Individual differences become primary rather than confounding variables. Inductive, qualitative methods provide data to derive theory that is grounded in the actual human experience. Variables that emerge from the landscape and context of families can then be identified, defined, operationalized, and for you scientists, even subsequently measured objectively. In order to systematically discover the subjective experience and then use such information to effectively help others, several things must happen. First, we need creative, systematic measures and methods to assure trustworthiness. Second, we must consider the entire family unit. Next, we must share and integrate interdisciplinary perspectives. And finally, we must go directly to the source. In our research with families with a child with disability, we gave families a camera and asked them to take pictures of events that were meaningful. Then we interviewed the entire family together, recording their interpretations of the photographs. Themes emerged of families working to be normal, challenged by extreme time demands and accommodation of special equipment, as well as joy in the child's progress and extended family support. We ended the interviews asking families to describe the picture most difficult to capture. We asked, what was the picture not taken? A father said, I would take a picture of my wife carrying all of us on her back. Another said, my picture would be of a thunderstorm. At the beginning of the storm, it's calm, and then all of a sudden, heck breaks loose. You go through the winds, and the rain pours down, and all of a sudden, it's blue and nice and great. That's the picture I would take of what it's like to live with a child with special needs. We've recently repeated the method, this time giving the cameras to the children who have a brother or sister with special needs. Preliminary results offer a powerful glimpse into the perspective and contribution of children to the entire family system. We've also tried a method using children's art, which has been called the language of children. Our use of children's art happened quite accidentally as we gave children colored markers and a space on their stress coping diaries to draw a picture as an enticement to complete the journals. The art itself became powerful data alongside the diary entries. I'd like to share a few of my favorites. This child's diary read, Tyler told my secret, I told him off. A 10-year-old boy wrote, no one would play with me. I got to play flies up. They let me. Notice the dark, primitive nature of the figures. The boy stands far up in the left corner at some distance from a mass of other stick figures. The tone is bleak and caused my concern about this boy. Next, we see a drawing of the same boy on a different day. Look at the mature, colored figures, including even his name on his shirt. His journal entry was, the best part of today was that I played football because I wanted to. Notice the difference in perception and control. One day they let me play, and another day I played because I want to. If any decision had been made on one of these regarding therapy, it might have been wrong. Here is evidence of the importance of collecting data from children over time. A 9-year-old girl wrote with her picture, I got kicked in the back at school. The best part of the day was I got to ride in an ambulance. It was the first time I ever did. Note the happy sunshine lines from the light on the ambulance, the attention drawn to the full figure of herself in what art therapists tell us are happy colors of blue and purple, and the little blue flowers in front of the school. We get a picture of a rather positive experience. Next was the drawing of the girl's 11-year-old brother on the same day. His diary entry said, my sister fell on a rock and hurt her back. She had to go to the hospital. I hope she will be okay. The figure of his sister is primitive and bleak. Standing over her is another person asking, are you okay? Notice the difficulty with the line of distance between himself and his sister, his empty expression, and the difficult attention to time on the clock. In the diaries from members of this family, attention for several days was directed toward the recovery of the girl, but we get insight from the direct perspective of the children through their own language of the need for attention to the entire family, that there was probably greater need for support for her brother. The expansion of valid measures for study is limited only by the perspective of the researcher. If we are studying families, we might recognize the systemic shared view that makes families different from a simple collective sum of their parts. We don't get a view of the entire family if we collect data only from the mother, the parents, or even the children. Further, as scientists, we cannot know about people and certainly cannot help people from a single disciplinary or theoretical viewpoint. As scholars, we must be willing to practice the art of perspective taking among ourselves. This is a special challenge for academics. We become more and more narrow, develop distinct languages, and publish in specialized journals. We could build bridges of professional sharing and jargon translation across our deep, narrow trenches of knowledge. I believe we can do better to help students make connections among the many bodies of knowledge they encounter in all their coursework. Here at BYU, with our shared moral and spiritual perspective, we have such potential for sharing our scientific perspectives. Finally, when seeking data about human beings, we need to have the courage to go directly to the source. Of course, we've always surveyed, measured, and studied about people, but we need data directly from their experience. This point came clear to me one evening in a restaurant when my children were young. As I repeated the usual litany of the children's menu to my then 5-year-old daughter, grilled cheese sandwich, hot dog, chicken nuggets, and spaghetti, the menu is always the same no matter what the restaurant, she interrupted indignantly, "This time I'm ordering from the human menu." I was fascinated by a recent article in a university alumni magazine. The author posed the following questions to physicians in 8 different specialties. What do you consider to be an aging woman's or man's primary health concern? A neurologist said Alzheimer's disease. A cardiologist responded heart attack or stroke. A rheumatologist described osteoarthritis. An ophthalmologist said cataracts. And a urologist said prostate disease and impotence. With the exception of one outlying gynecologist who said mental health, each had responded only from the narrow perspective of his or her academic specialty, and not one, not even the author, had appeared to ask a single aging man or woman. C.S. Lewis noted that we may come to love knowledge, our knowledge, more than the thing known, to delight not in the exercise of our talents, but in the act that they are ours, or even in the reputation they bring us. In several studies, we've asked children to respond from their own lived experience about daily hassles, stress, and coping by keeping semi-structured diaries over a period of several weeks. As you positivists might hypothesize, children often report a particular school subject as a source of stress. I love to ask adult scientific audiences such as yourselves, which school subject did children report with the greatest frequency as a source of stress? Adult responses are always the same, as I suspect even this enlightened audience might be whispering, math or science. Well, you are wrong. Children overwhelmingly list as the most frequent school stressor physical education. Think about it. Adults stress over getting the right answer to a math problem, but to a child, that pales to missing the ball and losing the game, exposing your thin or fat or slow or clumsy body to your friends, or not getting chosen for the team. I'll give you another chance. Which school subject do children most often report as the uplift or best part of the day? Music, art, or even lunch or recess? Wrong again. You are hopeless adults. Children say physical education. Not even the most creatively conceived art project can match the thrill of making the winning point, hitting the ball, or being chosen for the team. Colleagues from nursing and from family sciences and a great group of undergraduate students last semester interviewed school-age brothers and sisters of children with disabilities. The children exhibited profound reflection and desires for information about their brother or sister. When asked about his brother's condition, one child said, "I don't know if they don't want to offend us or what, but I want to know, like, what's up? Because people have asked me that before, like, what's wrong with your brother? And I don't know. I don't know what it is, and so I'd like to know what it is. Not just so I can explain it to people, but so I know." From our data drawn directly from the source, it's clearly evident that children not only contribute uniquely to the family system, but when given an appropriate vehicle, they are able to articulate their concerns and contributions with amazing clarity. From such findings, we're now discovering new theory to explain the roles of siblings in families with children with special needs. Among our families, we also interviewed fathers and mothers, asking about family challenges and strengths related to living with a child with disability. A prevalent theme among a subset of LDS families was the perception that living with a child with special needs was a spiritual experience, from which the family gained a deeply personal, eternal perspective and an ability to see purpose and blessings in their lives. I wish there were time to show the actual data. The purpose of our research was to identify factors of adaptation in families with children with special needs. If we had not gone to the subjective source, we may not have even considered the significance and power of the variable of religion in the families we studied. As we pursue how we know, it's also important to confront what we know and how we do not know. What is knowledge? What is faith? What is unknowing? Our coming to know changes us. For much of my own young life, I carried a naive knowing by my own empirical, perhaps even positivistic observation that obedience led to blessings and God answered every prayer exactly as requested. Certainly he had in my life. As a child, when I lost my red socks and, fearing my mother's reprisals, prayed to find them, they were there before I left my knees. Without an examination of my knowing or a trial of perspective, I grew up in a near-perfect knowledge of the word and hand of God in my life. But eventually I was confronted by serious crises. One crisis of doubt was most difficult. Nearly 10 years ago, on October 1st, the Saturday evening of General Conference, my 8-year-old son was suddenly killed. As sudden as his loss, vanished any personal knowledge of where or whether or not he existed. I knew where the scriptures told me he was. By authority and tradition, I knew where family, friends, and even church leaders told me he was. But I resented their assumption that I should find comfort because I should know where he was. I only knew the terrible empirical truth, the loss, the void. My only knowing was that he was gone. I felt my loss no less than an atheist mother. At least she had an empirical, positivistic certainty that her child did not exist at all. I did not know even that. However, what I did know was God. However wounded or tricked or angry I felt, I always knew God. I took my longing, perhaps faltering unknowing, to the source of all knowing. Submission of that unknowing to the will and workings of a Heavenly Father was for me the beginning of faith and of a powerful personal spiritual knowledge. I know about my son now with a certainty greater than my confidence in the results of my own research. I even have a comforting image of where he is. I know it now. My knowing comes from the source of that truth. Madeline L'Engle wrote, "I want to be open to God, not to what man says about God. I want to be open to revelation, to new light." The great artists, and I would add the great scientists, keep us from frozenness, from smugness, from thinking that the truth is in us rather than in God. They help us to know that we're often closer to God in our doubts than in our certainties, that it's all right to be like the small child who constantly asks, why? As we recognize and respect the sources of our knowing in a human science, as we share the theories and languages of each other in our learning, we are changed. We find a passion in knowing from many perspectives. Before our mortal parents were privileged with God to clothe us in flesh, we were spirit. But even before our divine parents endowed us with bodies of spirit, we existed uniquely, autonomously, and with agency. We were called intelligence. We learn from the 93rd section of the Doctrine and Covenants that intelligence is light and truth. We were in the beginning with God as intelligences that were not created or made, neither indeed can be. We always had substance, value, and agency. The scripture tells us otherwise there is no existence. We are told that the glory of God is intelligence, and whatever principle of intelligence we attain unto in this life, it will rise with us in the resurrection. These passages are often interpreted as the acquisition of external knowledge and skills, but that's a short measure of the full meaning of our potential. We have a marvelous promise for expansion of our ways of knowing, the magnification of the soul, body, and spirit, and intelligence, light, and truth in each of us. Thus, God's glory is the growth of our intelligence, our unique light, the original matter of our very being. Intelligences could grow and receive more light by cleaving to one another and could learn. I find it no coincidence and profoundly significant that our seminal divinity, that what makes you you and me me, always was, is light and truth and is called by God intelligence. As we become entangled in a telestial world, our lights meet with earthly bushels. When we speak of the parable of bushels, we often refer to the hiding of talents or skills. But I believe the real danger of bushels is that our ways of thinking, of pursuing knowledge, become narrow and obscured. As we cover our lights with false or rigid assumptions and futile intellectual pursuits, our intelligence may be diminished. We forget who we are. We are intelligence. C.S. Lewis affirmed the pursuit of knowledge in the sure confidence that by so doing we are advancing to the vision of God. He said, "The intellectual life is not the only road to God, nor the safest, but we find it to be a road. The life of learning, humbly offered to God, may be one of the appointed approaches to divine reality." It is my dream and my passion as a scholar that we who have the blessing and privilege to study may open our visions to learn from each other, both as scholars and as human beings, expand our perspectives of knowing, and recognize the promise of the divine in our learning, and God as the source of our knowing.